A Donald Trump presidency could have big consequences for Northeast Asia. On the campaign trail, candidate Trump put South Korea, a U.S. treaty ally, on notice. He said that if Seoul does not spend more in defense, he would consider withdrawing U.S. troops from South Korea. Candidate Trump also said he might not mind if South Korea or Japan became nuclear powers. And Trump also said he wants North Korea to halt its nuclear weapons program. He expects China to solve that problem for us. Here's a clip from an interview Trump did with CNN's Wolf Blitzer shortly after North Korea tested a nuclear device last January.
China can come out and frankly, they will, you know, they say they don't have that much control over North Korea. They have total control because without China, they wouldn't be able to eat. So China has to get involved and China should solve that problem and we should put pressure on China to solve the problem.
So you want China basically to handle the North Korea problem?
They can handle it so easily. Now they don't say that. You know, they say, well, they're not that easy, they're not that easy. They're taunting us, okay? They're playing games with us. I do it all the time. I mean, that's the way I deal in business. It's like they're playing games with us. China should solve that problem. And if they don't solve that problem, we should be very tough on them with trade.
I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations.
And I'm Robert McMahon, Managing Editor of CFR.org.
And you're listening to The President's Inbox. This CFR podcast examines the challenges President-elect Donald Trump will face after he is inaugurated on January 20, 2017. On this show, we talk about what he will find at the top of his foreign policy inbox when he arrives in the Oval Office. We're going to discuss what he has said he will do, what his priorities might be, and what challenges he could likely confront. This week, we're going to talk about North Korea. How will President-elect Trump handle that priority during his administration?
And to help us examine the North Korean threat is CFR's Scott Snyder. Scott is a senior fellow for Korea Studies and director of the program on U.S.-Korea policy. He's written a number of books on Korean politics and foreign policy. He's written in many other places as well and is a regular blogger for CFR's Asia Unbound blog. Scott, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
North Korea's nuclear program is often mentioned as one of the top challenges facing the incoming Trump administration. So, Scott, for starters, can you give us a sense of the nature of the North Korean threat?
Well, the challenge is that North Korea has tested a nuclear device. They've now done five tests since 2006, and they've been developing missile capabilities that are enabling the country to extend the range of its capacity to strike other countries. And the concern is that eventually North Korea may have the capacity to strike the continental United States with a nuclear warhead on top of an intercontinental ballistic missile.
Can you sort of narrow for us, Scott, what you mean by eventually? Are we talking a year down the road, 5 years down the road, 25 years?
I would say the intelligence community estimates suggest that North Korea could potentially have the capability to hit the United States already in a very simple way. But it would probably take 3 to 5 years to be able to achieve an assured re-entry capability for a device that is put onto an intercontinental ballistic missile that has to go outside of the Earth's orbit and then come back down in order to hit the United States.
Okay, because part of the challenge, as I understand it, is you not only have to be able to build a nuclear warhead and to be sure that it will go off, but you have to match it or mate it to a missile, precisely what you just pointed out, so that when you fire it up, you have a high reliability that when it comes down, it will explode. And that's what the North Koreans haven't yet mastered on an intercontinental basis.
I think that's the latest. That would be a correct assessment as far as I understand it from the intelligence community.
What about shorter range attacks? Because obviously North Korea could attack South Korea. It could attack Japan. I guess theoretically it could also attack China.
Yeah. North Korea, following its fifth nuclear test last September, claimed to have standardized a device that could go onto one of their missiles. The Nodong missile, among others, can hit Japan or South Korea. Even today, it's arguable that they have that capability. And in fact, the Defense Intelligence Agency, I think, assesses that North Korea has that capability.
So for both Japan and South Korea, the North Korean nuclear missile threat is not a future threat. It's a threat here and now.
And that would include U.S. forces in Japan and South Korea as well.
And aside from nuclear, it's worth noting that there is a conventional North Korean threat that's quite significant as well, certainly for South Korea and the U.S. forces based there.
That's right. The main thing to know there is that North Korea has been doing a lot of short-range missile tests, and they have begun to deploy 300-millimeter MLRS missile launch systems that extend North Korea's capability to reach farther down the peninsula as far as Taejon or Camp Humphreys, where the new main U.S. base is being established.
Now, the North Korean nuclear program has been around for quite a while, going all the way back certainly to the early 1990s when it first became an issue. A lot of talk about stopping the North Korean nuclear program. Maybe you can give us an assessment of why what's come before hasn't led to a stop.
Well, the North Korean nuclear program, I think, really came onto the agenda as a serious concern back in 1990 during the George H.W. Bush administration. There were some initial diplomatic contacts that occurred at that time, but the main diplomatic effort really came during the Clinton administration in 1993, 1994. At which time U.S. and North Korea made an agreement, a Geneva Agreed Framework, which involved the U.S. Leading a consortium that would build light water reactors in return for a freeze and eventual dismantlement of the North Korean nuclear
program.
What's
the significance of a light water reactor, Scott? Why would that be something the United States would want to do?
It was really an energy security approach to solving North Korea's problem. It's what North Korea said that it wanted.
So in theory, North Korea would be able to generate energy from having nuclear power.
That agreement broke down at the beginning of the Bush administration as a result of the discovery by the intelligence community that North Korea had a covert program where they were trying to use uranium as a way of developing a nuclear capability. When that program was discovered and presented to the North Koreans, the agreed framework fell apart. The Bush administration subsequently established the six-party talks. China, Russia, North and South Korea, Japan, and the United States as the main method by which to try to achieve some kind of solution with North Korea. Those talks actually achieved a general agreement about principles for addressing North Korea's nuclear program. It involved a commitment to denuclearization by North Korea in return for promises of economic assistance, diplomatic normalization between the U.S. and North Korea, and between Japan and North Korea, and pledges to discuss a possible peace framework to replace the armistice. Unfortunately, practical steps to achieve denuclearization foundered at the end of the Bush administration, and North Korea used the transition between Bush and Obama essentially to break out of that framework, at which time they conducted long-range satellite launch and a second nuclear test. And
because the missile technology to put a satellite in space is essentially identical to what you need to send a nuclear warhead across the ocean.
That's right. The satellite launch essentially doubles as a ballistic missile test.
And then they went through their own transition and a huge amount of speculation about what that was going to mean. And if anything, it's intensified this program, as you've noted many times on Asia Unbound. But let's take a step back, Scott, and talk about what's driving this. I mean, what do incoming Trump administration officials and others need to know about the North Korean regime, the nature of this regime?
Well, one of the challenges is that there is an ambiguity with regard to North Korea. On the one hand, the new leader is vulnerable. It seems like he's vulnerable domestically, although he's consolidated his power. But he seems like he's really focused on preserving his regime.
Still incredibly young.
He's in his 30s. At the same time, he's bound, because this is a hereditary succession, to a revolutionary ideology that was established by his grandfather, which looks at the United States as an imperialist force, and it's committed to unification of the Korean Peninsula on North Korean terms. And so the challenge, really, with North Korea's missile and nuclear development is that it gives Kim Jong-un capabilities that for the first time match some of the statements of intent that are reflected in this revolutionary ideology. And DPRK ambassador to the United Kingdom, Hyun Hak-bong, has something to say about that.
United States' hostile policy pushed the DPR Korea into having nuclear weapons. So, you know, if we want to cure somebody's illness, we should find out the root cause of the illness. It's all the same. If the nuclear weapons or nuclear program or nuclear issue could be resolved, the root cause should be resolved first. That is the hostile policy and nuclear threat by the United States.
So, Scott, this is a point that North Koreans come back to again and again. It has driven them to want to drop the whole six-party talk format altogether and make it two parties, U.S. and North Korea. Is that something that's actually realistic at all? And what's sort of behind that?
Essentially, what the North Koreans are saying is that the only way that they would give up nuclear weapons is if they had a normal relationship with the United States. But we all know that there are many political obstacles to potentially achieving a peace treaty between the U.S. and North Korea, given the nature of the regime, given the history. At the same time, we're at a point where even though the U.S. objective of denuclearization of North Korea remains, I think, the standard policy, it's very hard to see how this regime that has wrapped itself around nuclear weapons development is going to be willing to put that on the table. So essentially what we have is both the U.S. and North Korea offering up positions, starting positions, but with no intersection of space under which it would be possible to conduct any kind of negotiation on those terms.
So where do you see this going then, given that dilemma or contradiction in North Korean policy, Scott?
So the problem, I think, with North Korea is that it is a collective action problem. It involves U.S.-South Korea alliance cohesion. It involves support from Japan as an ally. And it also involves cooperation with China. And yet, it's almost impossible to imagine that everybody is going to be on the same page in order to achieve that objective.
In fact, the Chinese are upset about the deployment or the planned deployment of this THAAD missile defense system.
That's only one of the issues, I think. The core issue really is that when the U.S. looks at the peninsula, it thinks about Korean unification under South Korean terms, given North Korea's weakness. When China looks at the Korean peninsula, they want to see a Korean peninsula that's friendly to China. It can be unified or divided, but it does not want to see a unified Korea allied to the United States on the border with China's northeastern provinces.
But before we get into sort of the attitudes in the various countries around North Korea, could I just draw you out a little bit more, Scott, in terms of what life is like inside of North Korea today? You made the reference to the fact that the current leader of North Korea is in some sense vulnerable, but he's consolidated his power. Several years ago, there was just wrenching tales of famine that was leading to massive death tolls in North Korea. But sort of what is the state of politics in North Korea today, to the extent that we actually can understand it?
Under Kim Jong-un, North Korea is a regime governed by fear and terror.
It's a very closed society.
The problem that we have really with North Korea is that we don't see any evidence of external inputs. There's no world leader who can call up or visit Kim Jong-un and have a conversation. And so it gives the impression that his own objectives are completely formed by domestic needs. And given the way in which he has used fear in order to govern the people, it suggests that he also is not completely confident or sure of his own control.
But he's also taken a very different approach than, let's say, his neighboring country of China, which maintains a communist party but has much more exposure to the world. I mean, if you're in Shanghai or Beijing or Guangzhou, you can go on the internet. There is a great Chinese firewall and all of that, but Chinese citizens get access to information from outside of China. My sense is that North Korea access to the outside world is still restricted to a very small group of people.
The dilemma lies with the fact that North Korea is still relying on a personality cult. It's relying on inculcation of a way of thinking for its people. It relies on political loyalty, and it tries to monopolize information flows for the people. So if you're in North Korea, you're only getting one message, and that is it's very important if you want to survive in this society to be loyal to Kim Jong-un, to show your loyalty and praise, and don't cross any lines that might put you or your family at risk. And I think that it applies most strongly to people at the lower levels of society. Elites, I think, have a little bit more flexibility, but they also, as was evidenced by the way that by the demise of Kim Jong-un's uncle, who was killed at his order, essentially it showed that loyalty is paramount. And there's no other calling, including the potential to make a buck or improve your own status within society, that you should put above loyalty to Kim Jong-un.
Kim Jong-un's decision to have his uncle executed, his uncle was like number two or number three in the political hierarchy, came very early in his tenure. What was the rationale for the execution, which, at least according to press reports, was done in a very gory fashion, I believe using anti-aircraft weapons?
There have been reports that some senior officials have been executed using anti-aircraft weapons. I don't know if that applies to Jong or not. But essentially, he was publicly humiliated in a context where you control the media environment. Right. If you show your uncle being let off in handcuffs from a major party meeting, it's a severe humiliation, and it was designed to send a message to every other elite. I think the most reliable report is that Jong Song-taek and some of his subordinates were essentially pursuing financial gains in ways that crossed some of Kim Jong-un's feelings about whether or not Jong was showing loyalty. And so as a result, an investigation behind the scenes occurred, and Jong, who actually was arguably tantamount to the leader as the regent, was found guilty and then was taken out and disposed of. And so then, obviously, that was one critical step toward consolidation of power in North Korea. It certainly is an example that other generals appear to have heeded. If you've seen any pictures of generals coming into Kim Jong-un's presence, there's one picture where they stop about 10 to 15 feet away and they wait for him to signal that they can come. So it looks like Kim Jong-un's rule by fear is at least successful in terms of putting him in control of the military despite his youth.
And we don't know whose counsel he keeps to the extent he keeps anyone's.
Very hard to understand what constitutes decision-making or whether there is any subordinate who would dare to make proactive suggestions regarding policy issues in North Korea.
So in many ways, North Korea is like a black box for us.
Yeah, I think that's still the case.
But other totalitarian societies have over time, you mentioned the control of the media. There have been ways around that. You know, I'm thinking about the Soviet bloc, for example, and the way, you know, both the U.S. and other broadcasters used surrogate broadcasts. They're actually still doing it today in Korea, as a matter of fact, to get through, and they were over time successful. But it doesn't seem like that they're penetrating with North Korea.
Well, an information penetration strategy is certainly one major recommendation that many outsiders have made as a way of challenging the system in North Korea. And certainly it's something that a new administration would want to consider and could arguably be ramped up. It would also need to be done in an effective way. Some of the specifics of how the information dissemination campaigns have been conducted are subject to challenge. Arguably, if you use North Korean defectors, you can be more successful in terms of delivering messages that other North Koreans might be susceptible to hearing. But we certainly know that there is a large influence from South Korean drama and South Korean pop music that has come into
K-pop,
North Korea.
Right?
That's right. And that, I think, is also a source of change in North Korean society.
Let's look at the countries around North Korea that are affected by its policy. And let's, I guess, first talk about South Korea. Well, just note, currently, South Korea is going through a massive political tumult. President Park Geun-hye has been impeached. Under the South Korean system, that means she's suspended as president pending review by South Korea's constitutional court. And at some point, whether the court finds for or against her, South Korea is going to have a presidential election sometime in 2017. What is the attitude right now in South Korea looking north at North Korea? Is the case that South Koreans are hoping that their government will re-engage a sunshine policy, as it's called in the past? Or is South Korean political mood moving more harshly toward North Korea? Or is the country so focused on political turmoil that it's not thinking very much about what's happening north of the 30th parallel?
Well, I think the primary preoccupation of South Koreans has been with their own political challenges. Clearly, there have been hundreds of thousands of people in the streets of Seoul every weekend protesting the corruption by Park Geun-hye. But there's also and the issue of North Korea is obviously going to become front and center as part of any kind of election process that occurs in Seoul. I would say that there is a desire on the part of the public to see some kind of dialogue with North Korea, simply because you know that if there's communication, it reduces the risk of crisis. But at the same time, if you look at the way that North Korea is currently configured towards South Korea, essentially they've put the general who was in charge of some of the provocations that occurred back in 2010 is in charge of inter-Korean dialogue. And so one of the interesting questions is whether or not we can see some kind of evolution or change in North Korea, depending on how the election comes out in South Korea, that will actually facilitate some kind of inter-Korean dialogue.
What about looking Seoul toward the United States? Obviously, candidate Trump, as you noted at the top of the podcast, suggested that he's not satisfied with how much South Korea is putting into its own defense and that he might withdraw U.S. troops. How does that play into sort of South Korean calculations about North Korea?
Well, it's a source of concern for South Koreans because South Korea relies on the United States for its defense, even more so in the context of North Korea's nuclear program. One of the reasons why we've seen very high levels of support within South Korea for potentially acquiring a nuclear weapon among the public is really related to the perception that the U.S. and China are not really doing enough to address the North Korean issue. But support rates for a close relationship with the United States in South Korea remain high. They're in the 70 to 80% range. And really, there's not an alternative in terms of a security approach for South Korea. I think that most South Koreans, you know, they've had this experience before, right, actually, with Jimmy Carter, when he made a campaign promise to remove U.S. troops from the peninsula, and that was never implemented. And so I think actually South Koreans are maybe in a better situation than the Japanese have been because they actually have a point of reference for thinking about the possibilities related to Trump campaign promises. And as they look at it, they probably see that compared to the 1970s, there's a stronger U.S. ROK security relationship.
Their ROK democracy, being the acronym for South
that's
Korea.
That's right, a U.S.-South Korea security relationship. There is South Korea is a democracy. They've got better relationships with Congress.
They have a bilateral trade agreement also.
There's a, unless Trump decides to roll it back. But yes, the institutional ties that bind the U.S. and South Korea are much stronger today than they were in the 1970s.
And the number of troops there is it's about 30,000 at this point? What's the
28,000 forces in Korea. Mm-hmm.
And they do normal annual drills. There's obviously a big military drill they do, but they're in pretty much constant contact with the South Koreans?
Yeah, they're in very close contact. There's regular daily consultations. They do military exercises, major military exercises twice a year.
What about Japan, Scott? And I realize you're not a Japan expert, but obviously the Japanese are affected by North Korea's nuclear program. But we also know that South Korean-Japanese relations are often quite tense. Japan colonized South Korea. They have territorial dispute. How is that working out, and how does it play into this question of the North Korean nuclear threat?
Well, the main way I think that Japan plays into both the nuclear threat and the issue of tension on the Korean Peninsula is that Japan is the support base for U.S. troop flows that could come to the Korean Peninsula. But I think that North Korea's nuclear tests have also raised another issue, and that is that both South Korea and Japan are increasingly facing questions and doubts related to U.S. extended deterrence guarantees.
That's the idea that we will put Los Angeles or Washington at risk to defend Tokyo or Seoul.
That's right. If North Korea were able to strike the United States, we would be facing that kind of dilemma. Essentially, South Korea and Japan want to be reassured that the U.S. is going to take the measures necessary to prevent North Korea from using a nuclear capability against either Japan or South Korea. And it actually introduces complexity for North Korea to have this capability to hit Japan. Because Japanese may respond to North Korean nuclear threats differently from South Koreans. If it's a threat against Japan, then the Japanese might be more willing to say, oh, let's not pursue tough measures, whereas the South Koreans may feel that it's necessary to show resolve in the face of that kind of threat.
And you have in Shinzo Abe, you have someone who is sort of starting to feel his oats a little bit in terms of certainly he's got electoral support. He's raised the issue of expanding Japan's defense, you know, constitutional defense capabilities. And what does that signal, does that send to the South Koreans, you know, in terms of Abe and what he's meant to Japan and his sort of, you know, ability to sort of create change in the defense area?
South Koreans have been watching the adoption of collective self-defense in Japan under Prime Minister Abe very closely. They have tacitly accepted that Japan is going to have that capability, but they've also tried to establish markers, namely that Japan would have to consult with South Korea in advance of trying to deploy any troops on the peninsula. Also, over the course of the past couple of months, even despite this political paralysis in South Korea, we've seen that South Korea and Japan have adopted an information sharing agreement. Bilaterally. This is a step forward that I think the U.S. very much has wanted to see, and it essentially enables South Korea and Japan to be able to share intelligence information about North Korea in a way that they simply weren't able to do so in the past.
I know Bob wants to ask a question about China, but before we do, I want to go back to this question you alluded to, Scott, about the potential for South Korea and Japan to get nuclear weapons of their own, and that would take care of the issue of extended deterrence. They wouldn't have to rely on whether or not the United States was going to threaten nuclear war on their behalf. Candidate Trump, as we noted at the top of the podcast, suggested he might be open to that. I would imagine many people listening to the podcast might be asking, why wouldn't that be a good thing to have happen? Because it would provide sort of more deterrence in the face of the North Korean threat?
Well, I think it really comes down to how one looks at the issue of proliferation. What you're talking about really is because we have one outlier, North Korea, that is outside of the non-proliferation treaty, should we enable two additional countries to become nuclear capable? One can have theoretical debates about what this would mean for regional stability, but so far in our past experience, the alliance framework has been successful in providing regional stability and security.
If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yeah, I think there's a pretty powerful argument for keeping that framework. We'll see if Trump can be persuaded as he becomes president to adopt that framework. It appears that his selections for both Secretary of Defense and Secretary of State would be in favor of keeping that framework.
So at the outset of the podcast, we made reference to a soundbite from candidate Trump about China's role, and he repeatedly referenced to the ability of China to solve the problem, which he referred to as solving the problem, almost as if to, you know, flipping a switch and China can make this happen. But it's a lot more complicated, obviously, than that. Could you talk a little bit about, and the Chinese, by many accounts, seem to be exasperated with North Korea these days, but could you talk a little bit about how that relationship, how China's leverage could come to bear more than it has so far?
Well, the challenge is that China is the source of food and fuel for North Korea. They're the umbilical cord that keeps North Korea alive, but their main interest is in stability on the peninsula. And so they've got leverage that they can't use, essentially, because if they use the leverage, they're going to generate instability. They're going to open up the possibility that Korean unification could occur on South Korea's terms, and they would have a geostrategically unfavorable result if that were to occur. So, you know, the problem that we have, I think, in the United States is that cooperation with China is necessary in order to deal with North Korea, but it's not sufficient. And so the question is, what do we do? How do we expand and maximize cooperation with China while also taking additional measures? Some might say secondary sanctions as a way of doing this, but then that potentially puts at risk U.S.-China cooperation because the Chinese have said they're not in favor of secondary sanctions.
And we need the Chinese on lots of other issues.
That's right, or some other diplomatic measure. So, I mean, one possibility, I think it would make sense actually for a new administration to have a designated point person who really managed the North Korea issue as a way of separating it from the overburdened agenda in U.S.-China relations and also as a way of insulating it from the possibility of a downturn in U.S.-China relations.
So a special envoy for North Korea.
Essentially, in this case, not a special envoy for North Korea, but a special envoy for talking to China about North Korea, essentially. That person could also talk to others and kind of lead. You know, if this really is going to be a top-tier priority for an administration, you know, the concern is that it's also going to be a huge time sink. And so you actually need someone who's dedicated to leading that effort.
Well, on that note, we'll close up the President's Inbox for this week. Scott, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Be sure to subscribe to the President's Inbox on iTunes and leave us a review. It really helps. Please note that opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions. Today's episode was produced by Kevin Lizarazzo with senior producer Jeremy Sherlick and recording engineer Dan Mudd. Special thanks also to Audrey Bowler. This is Jim Lindsay.
And this is Bob McMahon. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week on The President's Inbox.